The president touts Bidenomics in the Menominee Valley.
We've added more jobs in 2 years than any president has in American history in a 4-year term.
While Republicans prepare for the first presidential debate at Fiserv Forum with or without the frontrunner.
Ronald Reagan didn't do it, and a lot of other people didn't do it. When you have a big lead, you don't do it.
As selection season gets underway, the eyes are on Milwaukee. From the Fox 6 studios, this is Open Record. I'm Brian Polson, and I'm here with Open Record's executive producer, Sarah Smith. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Brian.
We are recording this episode on Wednesday, August 16th, for release on Thursday, August 17th, and we are joined this week from Washington, D.C. by longtime Washington bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, now a Lubar Fellow at Marquette Law School, and a self-described chronicler of close Wisconsin elections. It's Craig Gilbert. Hey, Craig, thanks for coming on the podcast with us.
Hey, it's nice to be with you.
So, Craig, if there's anyone who knows how important Wisconsin is to presidential politics in the last 40 years, I think it's probably got to be you. You've written extensively about Wisconsin's role, not only as a closely contested state, which it always is, but as a tipping point for presidential elections. So before we get into what's going on next week here in Milwaukee and what's been going on recently, give us some sense of why is Wisconsin persistently such a battleground state, such a tipping point for presidential politics?
Yeah, I mean, on one level, it's kind of a mystery, right? I mean, you know, state borders are what they are. It's just sort of worked out that Wisconsin has an equal mix of Republican and Democratic voters. The bigger mystery to me is how the same state could remain a purple battleground over such a long period of time when our politics has changed so much. I mean, if you think about where the two parties get their votes, that's changed. If you look at the political geography and the map in Wisconsin, that's changed. Yet all these changes have kind of canceled each other out in a purely partisan sense. And so here we are, a state with, you know, a lot of urban voters, a lot of rural voters, a lot of suburban voters, and a state that is sort of perpetually in play at a time when most states, the vast majority of states, are safe states for one party or the other.
Do you think voters know that in Wisconsin? Do you think they know how important they are?
Oh, yeah. I think it's been drummed into them for decade after decade. I mean, the level of political advertising that occurs in all of these races, again, first and foremost for president, but also for governor, for U.S. Senate, the level of local media, the level of national media. This is also true in, you know, the age of social media and digital media. I think, you know, you basically have to be a hermit not to know this.
And obviously, presidential elections, while we think of them as national elections, they happen state by state, which is why states become so important. And in Wisconsin, we've had the last couple of elections in particular where the margin has been so razor thin, it's been less than a percentage point. And I think about, with a state of, you know, I don't know how many millions of voters, we have 5+ million people living in the state of Wisconsin. Obviously, that's a small number of people that can be turned one way or the other. Is that why we're seeing so much attention right now? I mean, the Republican National Convention is going to be coming here next year. You had the DNC that was supposed to be here and sort of was, other than the pandemic interference. But there's so much attention on Milwaukee. Is that just them vying for this razor-thin margin?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at, you know, again, the question of where parties put their conventions, they don't always put them in important battleground states. I mean, we've got lots of examples over the years of Democrats and Republicans meeting in states that are not, you know, that are not battlegrounds. But when they want to do it, when there's a battleground reason for locating it, there again, there's a limited number of states that make sense. And again, Wisconsin is probably one of about 5 states that will decide this next presidential election. It used to be the battleground was a lot bigger. When I started doing this, you know, in the late 80s and early 90s, you know, Wisconsin was a battleground state, but it was one of like 15 or 17 battleground states. So the fact that the playing field has narrowed so much, the way our politics has evolved, means that we're on a very short list now. We were on a much longer list a few decades ago.
I have to confess something, Craig. I was doing a little research about you yesterday because, and Sarah knows I do this before a lot of podcasts. We have a guest coming on or whatever, or a topic that I need to familiarize myself with. And I was looking back at some videos of you that are on the C-SPAN website dating back to the like late 80s. And there was what really struck me about your experience in reporting on this was a big breaking story that election season about this surprise victory by a guy named Russell Feingold. And it was, like this was an unheard of name. And it was, so that really takes you back.
Oh, yeah, that was one of the craziest, maybe the craziest race in some respects that I've ever covered. If people remember that, it was just a guy who was kind of a nobody in the Democratic field. And it was still at a time when, negative ads on TV were sort of shocking to the sensibilities of voters. And he won.
That.
He became a senator because his two Democratic rivals just annihilated each other on TV. And everybody was so shocked that they voted for this guy they, had probably never heard of before.
So we're recording this on Wednesday. We're 1 week out from the GOP debate here in Milwaukee. So all these Republicans are going to be coming here for the first presidential debate. Yesterday, Tuesday, President Biden was in Milwaukee. I think I know the answer to this, but do you think it's a coincidence that he was here 8 days prior to this debate?
No, not at all. And, people in Wisconsin are going to see a lot more of President Biden between now and November of next year. That's just politics 101, I think. It's a battleground state. They're doing a little advanced counter-programming to the Republican debate that will happen here next week. And again, he'll be back again and again.
Let's talk about that debate because it is on Wednesday, August 23rd. Fox News is hosting this and it's going to be at Fiserv Forum, 8 o'clock next Wednesday. And before we get into that debate, we have one of our editors here, editor here of Open Record, brought this up, and he said it's really interesting the format of this because you've got 10,000 people who are going to be, in theory, at Fiserv Forum watching this as an audience. What do you think of the impact of a large audience like that watching a debate? How does that affect how the candidates respond to questions? Sort of the whole atmosphere of a debate versus one that is maybe held in a closed studio for people to watch.
Yeah, I think all these things have a profound effect on debates. The audience has a profound effect. The number of candidates on the stage, how they're positioned on the stage, whether it's in studio or in front of a crowd, because it affects, the way we see the debate and perceive the debate as members of the audience, but it also affects the participants in the debate. I mean, it shapes the way they debate. If you have a crowd, people are they are going to be at times playing to the crowd in the room, but at other times they're going to be playing to the audience at home, which is much bigger. They're also playing to the media, which is the institution and the means through which this debate story is really going to be communicated to more people than actually watch the debate. So it's really been pretty fascinating. I was on a panel of a debate in Milwaukee, a Democratic presidential debate back in 2004. And so seeing it from the inside and seeing the way all the staging and all these things we've been talking about kind of shape the way the candidates in the debate treat each other and the way they behave is really fascinating. And we'll see that next week.
That's what I wondered. Does it encourage the sniping and the little quips and things that are going to get an immediate audience reaction and maybe play well on YouTube or something like that?
Yeah, I think sometimes the candidates are, looking for that affirmation from the crowd. Other times they're looking to kind of separate themselves from the crowd, maybe even inviting boos at times. Like I said, where they're sitting and who they're standing, where they're sitting or standing and who they're sitting or standing next to can have an effect, whatever their tactics and strategy are going into the debate. It can have an effect on their mindset during the debate.
So I think the big question that a lot of people are asking, a lot of the articles I've read, probably some of these candidates themselves are asking, is if Donald Trump will be one of the people involved in next week's debate.
Yeah, so people who are puzzling this are all trying to put themselves in the head of Donald Trump. And I think if you do that, you sort of have to decide whether you think the former president, thinks he can you know, advance himself more by, or let me put it differently, he can diminish his opponents more by appearing on stage with them or by shunning them by not appearing on stage. I mean, I think I wouldn't be surprised either way. I do think he runs the risk of diminishing himself by not appearing, just because, you know, he's the de facto incumbent in this race. He's the dominant figure in the race. He's the clear and obvious front runner in the race. So I think by not appearing, he not only gives the other candidates in the race more space to kind of set themselves apart and distinguish themselves and get noticed, but he also, you know, potentially kind of looks, you know, weak or just, you know, he's not projecting the image that he likes to project to Republican voters.
It would be a surprise to no one, though, if the battle that's going on, I wonder if it's not the battle that's going on internally for him, is one of strategy versus ego. He loves to be the center of attention. And if there's a debate that takes place on Fox News and Donald Trump isn't there, is that for him just hard to miss out on, even if it's the strategically right thing to do?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, you know, he's going to be the center of attention, even if he's not on the stage. But absolutely, I think he thinks that he can, I think he thinks he's a great debater. And I think he thinks he's a better debater than these other Republicans in the race. So I think on one level, it would seem to be kind of irresistible for him to be there. On the other hand, you know, he is the front runner, and he even skipped a debate 8 years ago when he wasn't as clearly established as the front runner as he is in this race.
Do you think the other candidates will prepare differently? I mean, I obviously being a wild card, I think he's, like you said, I think his name is, will be brought up whether he's there or not. So do you think they're preparing differently?
Yeah, I think they have to prepare for two very different kinds of debates. I mean, the other candidates, you know, face a lot of challenges and face a lot of dilemmas. Obviously, if Donald Trump is on the stage, you know, they face the dilemma, which has been kind of plaguing them, you know, throughout these early stages of the Republican nominating fight, which is just, you know, can they afford to attack Donald Trump, or can they afford not to attack Donald Trump? It's kind of almost a paralyzing position to be in, given how his dominance and his popularity among Republican voters. On the other hand, if Donald Trump is not on stage, they don't have to worry quite as much about that. And it's really more of how do they position themselves vis-a-vis the other Republicans in the race. I think it does require, you know, two different sets of strategies. And I think they have to prepare for either one.
Now, we have a long list of the other candidates that are going to be there. It's not quite as big as it was in 2016, when there was just a huge list of candidates in the Republican primaries. But we have, I think, seven others that have qualified to be on stage for the debate next week. And obviously the name that we've heard most about is Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. But since his official announcement, he's actually lost quite a bit of support in the polls. And that's been spread out among these other candidates that are coming into the race. In some respects, you look at the numbers, the most recent Marquette Law School polls, and say, Donald Trump is running away with this. There's no way any of these others could possibly stand a chance. But if you add up all of the other, the sort of non-Trump people, well, it closes the gap somewhat. Is that really what this is about? Is it about winnowing the field to a single competitor for Donald Trump? And does that one competitor, whether it's Ron DeSantis or Vivek Ramaswamy or whoever it is, do they stand a chance? Or is this a foregone conclusion for Donald Trump?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a foregone conclusion. He's in a very powerful and dominant position. I think, and that becomes clear, and I think you're getting at the underlying kind of structure of this race, which is, you know, 2/3 or 3/4 of Republican primary voters, you know, like Donald Trump, have a positive view of Donald Trump. And he's getting, you know, a majority of that majority. And so, the number of Republican voters that don't like him are kind of the voters that are really the most in play, but it's a small group. So if you're competing with Donald Trump for the nomination, you know, you need to try to consolidate that anti-Trump vote within the Republican Party. But that by itself isn't enough, because you still need to kind of win some minority chunk of the pro-Trump voters in the party. You can't do without them. So, you have to build a coalition of, you know, quote, anti-Trump and quote, pro-Trump Republicans, which is difficult to do when, you know, you're again, faced with the dilemma of whether to attack Trump or not. So that really underscores his dominance. I think the hope and the path for Trump's rivals is that, you know, this is a sequential fight of one primary after another, state by state. And, you know, when the first state Iowa votes and the second state New Hampshire votes, you know, each time one of those states votes, it changes everything. It changes the field. It changes the dynamics. So you have to think about, you know, what you need to do in the first state to survive in order to get to the second state.
Part of a big, obviously a big chunk of what this debate is talking about issues. So what do you think some of the big issues are that these candidates will be asked about on Wednesday?
Well, I think they're certainly going to be asked about former President Trump's legal jeopardy. And again, I don't think that's a discussion that's necessarily all that helpful to Trump's rivals, because they don't want to go too far in criticizing him, because most Republican voters have a very negative view of these indictments and the legal system. But they're going to get asked about it, and they're going to have to figure out, you know, how to thread that needle on that question. And then I think beyond that, you know, there are a lot of issues where I think the answers are kind of more obvious, or the strategy is more obvious for Republican candidates when it comes to, you know, talking about President Joe Biden's record, when it talks, we're talking about the economy, talking about, I mean, foreign policy will be one interesting issue to watch, because there is a component of the Republican Party that, for example, is not all that supportive of the help that we're giving to Ukraine against Russia. So the issues like that, abortion, another issue where even though the party and all these candidates are, quote, you know, are opposed to abortion rights, there are differences in how far they want to go. And we've seen, obviously, that issue being a liability for Republicans in a number of states since the Supreme Court ruling overturning Roe v. Wade.
When you think about the non-Trump, you know, the opponents that he faces, the Trump rivals here, there are a couple of ways to measure how they're doing early on. One of them is polling, but polling is only one measure. Another is obviously money. You think of the old investigative reporting tenet, follow the money. If you look at some of the candidates here, I mean, if you look at the numbers in the latest Marquette Law School poll, you'd say, well, Mike Pence is right up there with some of the others in terms of being the top challengers to Donald Trump. But if you look at his fundraising, it was awful compared to some of the others. And then I look at someone we haven't heard a whole lot about, South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, and yet he's got a pretty big war chest. So how important is what's in the bank right now to what may happen in the coming months?
Yeah, so obviously that's a big part of the equation. And, you know, the money is what you need on the ground as you get into these states and you're campaigning, whether it's, you know, digital campaigns, whether it's television ads. And also the money itself, as you were talking about, is kind of a symbol. It's kind of a metric. It's a barometer of, you know, how you're doing and also your potential as a candidate. So aside from the actual, you know, resource, the use of the resources, it's also just kind of an embarrassment, I think, for candidates who can't raise money, because it affects the way they're perceived. And it's kind of a vicious cycle. I mean, the donor base is, you've got big donors who don't want to give to a candidate that they don't think is going anywhere. And that's true to some extent also of smaller donors who may be giving more with their heart than with their head, but they also don't want to see their money wasted. And so in the case of some candidates we've seen, you know, historically have done really well with big donors, but didn't have the grassroots money. And that wasn't necessarily a good sign. It was a sign they had establishment support, but it wasn't a sign that they had the kind of grassroots support that reflects, you know, your ability to win primaries on the ground. So the money matters.
Next week, obviously, a big week for Milwaukee, a big week as we lead into next year's convention in Milwaukee. The city is going to host a convention vendor fair. There's the RNC summer meeting. Obviously, the preparations have already started for 2024. What kind of impact do you see this having on the city, not just from an economic standpoint, but from a political standpoint?
Well, I think, you know, it's a kind of a unique situation when you've got basically the rest of the country and the world, you know, obviously they're watching a party convention, but they're watching it in a place. And so that is kind of an amazing opportunity and a challenge, I think, for any city. You know, that city wants to, and that state wants to do the best job it can possibly do and put its best face forward. You don't always have control of that. There's also all kinds of, you know, wild card and X factor things that can happen to kind of affect the way, you know, the attention that a city gets through it. I mean, you could have like protests,
pandemics,
have pandemics, which obviously, you know, really wiped out the Democratic convention in Milwaukee last time around. You can have the way, you know, the people in the city are treating the visitors. And again, this, you know, it can be unpredictable. I think, you know, cities generally, you know, extend hospitality to their visiting parties. It's always interesting when you have, you know, a Republican convention in a Democratic city. Most cities, you know, we know this about the way American politics works. Most cities are pretty Democratic or pretty blue, and Milwaukee's no exception. So I think, you know, that's going to be an interesting thing to watch. When I was at the Republican convention in New York City in 2004, again, an example of the party going to a city that was not in play. It was not even good for that party, but it was because of the symbolism of 9/11 and the Bush reelection campaign. There were times when, you know, delegates were getting, you know, booed and, you know, jeered at on the streets because, you know, New Yorkers are Democrats. And so, you know, will we see any of that? It's going to be really interesting to watch. But I think, you know, I think cities fundamentally approach this as a great opportunity to raise their profile in a good way.
You're going to be here for the debate next week. What are you looking for when you come here, and what are your plans when you're in town?
Well, you know, just to reconnect with a lot of people in the political world, but in terms of the debate itself, you know, again, there are battles within the battle. And obviously the fight among Donald Trump's rivals to be seen as the chief alternative or a chief alternative to Donald Trump is a really important one at this stage of the race. And again, to some extent, that's a battle to consolidate the anti-Trump vote, but it's also a battle to appeal to Trump voters who may be in play. So that's a pretty critical segment in this overall fight, is if you're a Republican voter who tells a pollster, yeah, I like Donald Trump, I have a positive image of Donald Trump, but you're open to other candidates because maybe you question whether Donald Trump is electable, or maybe you just have sort of a level of fatigue with all of his baggage and you worry about the legal process, maybe you're open to somebody else. So I'll be really looking, and I think a lot of observers will be looking at what this debate means, you know, not just for Ron DeSantis, but for Tim Scott, for Nikki Haley, for Mike Pence, for some of these other candidates, and their ability to kind of, you know, carve out the beginnings of a path to not only surviving Iowa and New Hampshire, but becoming a viable alternative to Donald Trump. And so it's going to be interesting to see that, you know, at the debate in terms of the live audience, and also, you know, the body language and the language of the candidates on stage, and also just sort of the reactions and in Wisconsin, in the political world in Wisconsin, because Wisconsin is a state that matters. And Donald Trump has an interesting history with the Republican Party in Wisconsin, which you can talk about if you want.
Well, that is, when you think of obviously his history in particular with Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, that's been quite an interesting history. So maybe tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you really, you know, take a step back and look at the big picture, I mean, Wisconsin's legacy in 2016 in the fight for the Republican nomination was it was the last big defeat for Donald Trump on his way to the nomination. Donald Trump was not popular here at that point in the process. He got beat badly by Ted Cruz, and he got beat really badly in the most Republican parts of Wisconsin, in the very Republican suburbs, outer suburbs of Wisconsin. He got shellacked in that primary. And so, Then you had the drama of Donald Trump's relationship with the big Republican names in Wisconsin, Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, Scott Walker, who he kind of drove out of the presidential race, and Reince Priebus, the state party chair, went on to become, became national party chair and then became White House chief of staff. And that's before we even get to Robin Voss, the Speaker of the Assembly, who he's tangled with. So Wisconsin, you know, there are some states where there's been a complete Trump takeover of the Republican Party apparatus. And that is not true of Wisconsin. Wisconsin still has a lot of kind of people who cut their teeth in the party pre-Trump and who have more complicated relationships with Trump, who are still important figures in the Republican Party in the state.
Does that make it awkward at all when, as all of this is going on with the RNC coming? I mean, are there going to be some awkward relationships as all of these party members get together?
Sure. I mean, the potential is certainly there. Again, you've had, I mentioned Paul Ryan, the former House Speaker who's out of politics, but he's been, you know, going around telling everybody that, you know, Donald Trump should not be the party's nominee because he's not electable. And so I think these are the kinds of stories that are natural, you know, angles for journalists covering, whether it's the debate next week or covering the convention when it's in Wisconsin. You've got thousands of journalists, you know, searching for story angles. And one of them is this thing we've been talking about, which is his complicated history in Wisconsin with other Republicans, his complicated relationship with some important Republicans in the state. You know, with that said, he is still, you know, a majority of Republican voters in Wisconsin, you know, view former President Trump favorably. And so he still kind of enjoys that level of popularity, even within the Republican Party, even in Wisconsin.
That's a good time for us to go off the record. This is the part of the podcast where we get a little more casual and have a little fun by answering a question for which we have not prepared. And here, as always, ask that question is Open Records executive producer Sarah Smith. What do you have, Sarah?
Oh, boy. Okay, so Craig, I assume you're going to be flying from D.C. to Milwaukee next week. Question this week is, what is the worst thing someone can eat on an airplane?
I have a pretty easy answer right away for that, and that's tuna.
Oh, okay.
Like a tuna sandwich or a tuna packet or something. Something that's got that, it just
pungent.
Permeates. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you can't get away from that.
But do you ever smell it and get hungry?
No. Okay. I mean, it's not that I don't like tuna in the right situations.
Just
but
not in
it
the confined
I don't,
space.
That's not an odor that makes me go, I'm really craving some tuna right now. No, not at all.
Craig.
I don't know. It's Wisconsin, so can I say stinky cheese?
Oh, yeah.
not like a cheddar, which is fantastic. You're like a Limburger, right? Or something, or yeah.
Yeah. I remember in the 2004 campaign when John Kerry was campaigning in Wisconsin, his wife Teresa Hines, who's European, we stopped at this classic Wisconsin venue, which is a cheese store / tavern.
Sounds as Wisconsin as it can be.
In southern Wisconsin, and. And she ordered the stinkiest cheese they had, and it was pretty memorable.
Pungent. I was going to say something. The smells are one thing. Like if someone pulls out a sub with onions on it, I love onions, love subs, but maybe not in an airplane. But things that are loud, like crunchy chips or like corn nuts.
So you're more disturbed by the sound of the eating.
I mean, I guess sometimes the airplane ambient noise kind of drowns them out. But man, if they're right next to you crunching.
I would imagine if you work on airplanes, it would be popcorn because of the popcorn falling all over the floor. It's like cleaning up a theater afterwards, and now you've got kernels of popcorn all over the place. But I don't know. I guess I don't actually fly. You probably fly more than I do, I'm guessing, as someone in D.C. covering politics, Craig. But I don't fly enough. And actually, what I realize more and more now is because planes don't serve the food they used to, it is people bringing their own stuff on. So you are stuck with whatever someone decides is their favorite snack. And if you busted out stinky cheese or tuna next to me, I think I'd have concerns about that.
Wait, well, Kale, our chief photographer here, manning the cameras.
For me, it's got to be something with olives. So especially if you're close to them and they have like a plate of olives or something. I don't know why you would have that on a plane.
Why
but like the smell of olives, I just, it's I can't
take What if it's a cocktail with an olive in it? That's okay?
Yes, because then you're not really smelling it.
But I guess I never thought of olives as all
having
that
a stench.
They smelly. Do. Really? Olives are smelly, yes. And okay. If they're out, I can smell them.
Are these like gourmet olives that you have? Because
no, it doesn't matter. Any olives. Doesn't matter. The okay. smell, I just you know, can't, at the, can't
at
do
the,
it.
At the opposite end of the spectrum, and fortunately it's a short flight from between DC and Milwaukee, but at the opposite end of the spectrum, you know, the old airline that, you know, used to serve that route, Midwest Express.
The cookies.
You know, not only serve chocolate chip cookies, but they serve warm
they
chocolate
were
chip
warm. Cookies.
Yes. Oh, so that was the best.
It just, they filled the cabin with the scent.
You're not wrong.
Warm, you know, the chocolate.
The best thing about that from a marketing standpoint was there are times you're thinking this flight might be $75 more than the next one.
Doesn't matter.
But the cookies. As though the somehow they,
the
you couldn't just for $75 buy some warm chocolate chip cookies in the airport terminal and bring them out. No, but that was a powerful motivation. It was a great marketing tool. We
and
miss
the free wine and beer.
that would also work. Well, Craig, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. And we look forward to having you in town, welcoming you back to Milwaukee for the debate next week. But thank you, as always, for your time here on the podcast.
Absolutely. And good luck with your coverage of the debate.
All right. If you have time, or if you have a topic, rather, that you would like us to discuss on Open Record, or an issue you think we should investigate for Fox 6 News, send us an email to fox6investigators@fox.com. As always, thank you to the people who make this podcast possible, including our executive producer, Sarah Smith, our editor, Dave Machuda, and our chief photographer manning the video switcher, Kale Zimney. With that, I'm Brian Polson. We'll be back next week.